Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today I have a special treat. I've been wanting to do an interview on Emmanuel Velikovsky for a long time, and I really haven't found anyone that I really thought knew a lot about him on a personal level and his background and just kind of all around. I haven't really found that attachment yet of who I wanted to interview, and I think I have him. Well, I know I have him. His name is Irving Wolf, and he knew him personally. He was a colleague of his. He knew him personally, and he has a lot of information to share about Velikovsky. He's an amazing person, Velikovsky is. I think he's what he brought forward is ultimately, along with the electric universe and other things that people are working on, like Wallace Thornhill, it's going to change every discipline. When we're talking about science and medicine and archaeology and just the way we look at the framework of our past and our future is going to change from what he came up with. And it was very revolutionary. And now we have new people carrying that torch and really bringing it into science and other areas of the world and seeing it from different perspectives. I think we're at a tipping point of those ideas coming forward and really changing the way we look at almost every discipline. So I'm excited to do this interview, but I want to tell you that for my patrons, I did an extra question for them, and we dive into what Emmanuel Velikovsky is as a person. So if you are a patron, go to Patreon Sarah Westall, and you can get all of those videos that I've been doing and a couple of my books. Just so I let you know, supporting my show is not very expensive. For those that do not have very much money, $1 a month, and you can get access to all of my stuff there. And I appreciate everybody so much who supports the show. It really keeps this work going. So let's get into the interview now with Irving Wolf. Hi, Irving. Welcome to the show.
Nice to hear from you.
Well, I've been wanting to do this interview for the last couple of years, so I'm very thankful that you joined us today. First, can you start off and tell us how you knew Emmanuel Velikovsky? Because you were friends, right? Or colleagues?
Yeah,
go ahead.
I became involved because I picked up his first book, the blockbuster Worlds in Collision, and I started to read it, must be 30, 40 years ago. And then one thing just led to another. I became very excited. It changed the way I saw everything in life. I used to come running into the kitchen where my wife is cooking, and I would say, "Now stop, just listen to this." And I'd be jumping up and down, reading it, and she thought, "Well, he's crazy." And then an hour later, I was back in the kitchen again, screaming, "Now you've got to hear this part," and so on. So it was a revelation for me.
Well, I think it has been for a lot of people, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Why do you think he is so relevant today?
Well, let's put it this way. When his books first came out, there were three or four of them in a short span in the 1950s. It was a bombshell because he was not attacking, but his theories were implicitly attacking almost every major scholarly discipline in the universities, and most of the scientific ones. In other words, if he's right, they're all wrong, all of them. And his theory was unified, and he put it all together in a series of books, but each one sort of connects with the next one, and it was a revolution. Let's put it that way.
Well, let's start with The World in Collision, which is the real famous book. What did that first propose? And then what I'd like you to do is tell us about that book and then kind of step us through the other books and what he actually proposed.
Well, here's how we go. He perhaps in retrospect should not have published Worlds in Collision first, because that was the most revolutionary one and it provoked the strongest hostile reaction from science. So I'll try and trace sort of how his thought went. What he noticed was that in almost all the world's religions, the stories they tell present pictures of worldwide catastrophes, if you know how to decode what they're saying. And he traced this all the way around the world and found that they were telling more or less the same story about huge convulsions, global in size, that happened not too long ago. Not too long means not 50 million years ago or 1 million years ago, but within, let's say, the last 4,000 years, which would be modern culture within human memory. Mm-hmm. And so he checked this and he said to himself, all of these religions, if you decode them properly, seem to be telling the same story. So, how to check whether it's true? Now, his next book, which was not Worlds in Collision, but is called Earth in Upheaval, deals with geology and anthropology all around the world. In other words, he found stories of continents that were set ablaze by fire, of trying to calculate the age, let's say, of the Niagara River, the age of the falls. And all of this went back, I would say, to about 4,000 years ago. In other words, the actual scientific papers said that these things all happened 3,000, 4,000 years ago, not millions of years ago. So he developed the theory that there must have been worldwide catastrophes that happened, which were recorded in a coded mythological form in religion, but which, if you look at the earth sciences, were able to be proved as actually having happened. So this led him to an enormous thought, because he then began to paint a picture of what happened on our earth 4,000, 3,000, and 2,000 years ago. And when he came up with the total picture, it's all unified. Worlds in Collision is evidence mostly from comparative religion. Earth in Upheaval is very solid, ordinary evidence that anybody can read and believe from geology and anthropology and the earth sciences. Now, he then had to reconstruct ancient chronology, because if his theories were right, then the ancient chronology, which was built mostly on Egyptian, was wrong by hundreds of years. So he ended up proposing that the chronology which was being taught at the universities was off by anywhere from 400 to 700 years. So he rewrote ancient chronology. He rewrote the history of the geological and natural history of the world. He rewrote the history of how religions were formed and what they're trying to say to us. And he also, because he was a psychologist, dealt with the effects on human beings. And his theory was that part of us remembers these things because the memories are transmitted biologically. So part of us is as old as our birth certificates, but part of us is very much older, and we have these memories buried within us, and it makes us do all kinds of irrational, stupid, and murderous things. So really, he's explaining why humanity is making such a mess out of life on the earth, because he was, in effect, psychoanalyzing all of human nature. So all of this came together in a series of books, and a couple of outcomes. Number one, big science got together and attacked him. Now, normally, if a person comes out with a theory that seems impossible, scientists just ignore it. But here, all the paraphernalia of large science were put together to try and attack Velikovsky and destroy his books. And this came out as the Velikovsky Affair, which is a separate story, but then you have to ask yourself, why was Big Science so fanatically opposed to Velikovsky? What they did was they tried to block the publisher who was publishing his book. It was number one on the hit parade. So the publisher was forced to give the book over to another publisher that didn't have scientific textbooks, so they couldn't be blackmailed. All sorts of articles were put out against Velikovsky in the journals. He was not given a chance to reply. They really tried to destroy him. If it had been 400 years earlier, they would have tried to burn him at the stake, too. They couldn't, but they tried to destroy his influence and his books.
Was he famous at the time and well-respected?
Oh, yeah, everybody. From 1950 to about 1960, everybody in America knew the name Velikovsky and what he was proposing and the scandal and the stories and the fact that science didn't believe him and was trying to destroy him. It was a scandal, and it was well known. And there is proof that the major astronomer named Harlow Shapley, who was the number one man at Harvard, is the one who literally organized the boycott of his books and the publishing of all kinds of articles against him, the suppression of any articles that he tried to publish on his behalf, and they thought they would simply destroy him and his ideas, but it didn't work, because slowly a number of people came on board in the 50s, and then in the early 60s, I would say, Dave Talbot, whom I think you have interviewed?
I interviewed Wallace Thornhill. He is somebody else that I would like to interview. I just haven't gotten around to it.
Dave Talbot and his brother, who were running a scientific journal, dedicated a series of 10 issues of that journal to the Velikovsky story. And by that time, a lot of interesting scientists in many fields were coming on board. So more and more people got to know about Velikovsky. And in the 70s, in the early 70s, a number of conferences were held about his ideas. He spoke at a number of universities. He received an honorary degree at a university in Western Canada, and I was invited to speak at that one, and that's where I met him. But, you see, my field is Shakespeare. And one of the things I was wondering about was, what makes Shakespeare eternal? Why does he last? And my feeling was, it's more than just the interesting characters and the interesting stories and the beautiful poetry and so on. There's something else that he's touching us, and we respond to it. And I realized after a while what it was, that Shakespeare, in many of his plays, was rewriting the Velikovskian catastrophes in disguise with a happy ending. And so it became a psychological theory of mine that we have to keep returning to these catastrophes because they're too horrible to be suppressed safely and told to lie there and shut up. They keep threatening to come back. So the creative artists are the ones who create narratives whereby we can revisit the catastrophes in a disguise and have a happy ending, and it makes us feel better. So I submitted a couple of papers to the Talbots, and they published them. And the next thing you know, I was invited to come out to Lethbridge, and I met Velikovsky, and he sort of sized me up and down and allowed me to be admitted into the group, and that's how it all started. Now, in the early 1974, Big Science was so terrified because every week Velikovsky was appearing at another university and talking to people and so on, that they organized the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS, organized a conference in San Francisco in 1974, and they allowed Velikovsky, they said, you have three people to speak for you, and we'll have three people to speak for us, and we'll have a full-day conference. Well, Carl Sagan, who was the major astronomical figure in Big Science at the time, told Velikovsky that he, Sagan, would bring along two or three people who would speak for Velikovsky and three people who would speak against. But it turned out that the AAAS symposium was an ambush. In other words, all of the speakers proclaimed that, whether they were allegedly on his side or against him, proclaimed that they don't agree with any of his ideas. And the thing went on morning and afternoon, and he was 77 years old, all by himself, and he had to stand up against them all, and it was disreputable. So science tried to destroy him again. But then an important journal started up in England, and they held a big conference in 1978, and they were very strong in ancient history and so on. So they have been publishing, and then a journal started in the United States called Kronos, which went for about 10 issues, and they published all sorts of stuff by important scientists. I had papers there. And then we started a Canadian Society for Interdisciplinary Studies, and this went on for about 10 years. So you couldn't stop the avalanche. Everybody thought Velikovsky was dead, but he wasn't. He was just underground, and he kept going. Now, Wall Thornhill got involved with Dave Talbot because Wall is a scientist, and he was interested in different explanations of the physical universe. So Velikovsky had said all along that the major force in the universe is electrical or electromagnetic. All major scientists disagreed with him. When Velikovsky moved to Princeton, Einstein was one of his neighbors, and they both spoke German, and they used to argue all day, and Einstein held, until his death, I would say, that the universe was neutral. There was no net charge on the major bodies. But of course, the moment you allow that, everything changes. So Wall Thornhill got on board with that, and in the middle 80s, early 90s, he and Dave Talbot began to work together, and out of that came what is called the electric universe. Now, my feeling is that if you look at the history of science for the last 150 years, Albert Einstein published his two most revolutionary papers, the special relativity and general relativity, in the first two decades of the 20th century. And they revolutionized physics so that after Einstein, the conception of the physical world changed forever. And so he changed physics completely early in the 20th century. Now, if Wall Thornhill and his gang are able to prove that electricity and electromagnetism are major factors in the universe, then he will create a revolution early in the 21st century, around the same time, because it's now 2017, that will change the way everybody sees the physical universe from now on. So Wall Thornhill is really carrying on Velikovsky's theories and pushing them further. So you have a whole lot of things involved. Velikovsky's physical theories, his ancient chronological revisions, his analysis of human psychology as a result of our ancestors being victimized by the catastrophes, and then you have Wall working on the electric universe, and if it happens, then it will be very, very major. So you've got to interview him. I mean, Wall is a nice, quiet guy, very serious, very Australian, and he just continues his work with a whole lot of scientists, and if they're turning out stuff, you see, somebody reading Einstein's papers in 1905 and 1916, did he know what he was holding in his hands? Was this the future of physics, you know? So the same thing with Wall. It could be greatness. It could be completely revolutionary.
Yeah, I've interviewed him twice, and he's absolutely amazing. I think the electric universe is a tipping point. We're close to a tipping point.
Sure.
Because more and more scientists, more and more reputable scientists.
Absolutely.
Universities, people are getting on board and saying, this is all proving out.
Absolutely. Look, if you look at the conferences that Dave Talbot has organized, the one I spoke at last summer was number 6 or 7. I think it started in 2012. Well, there was a young fellow there called Ben Davidson. And it's nice to see younger people coming along, because some of the people I know or have known have now passed away. And we were wondering, to whom are we going to pass the torch? Well, these young people are getting together, and one of them put up a diagram. Now, I don't know how much you know about astronomy, but I had been taught that the largest structures in the universe are clusters of galaxies. And the largest cluster was called the Laniakea Cluster, which is about 7 billion light years across. Now, 4 years later, they found a number of clusters which are larger. The biggest one right now is called Hercules, and it's just over 10 billion light years across. It doesn't mean he's the biggest, it's just the biggest that's been found up till today. But he put up a diagram and showed it at last year's conference. And on this diagram, at one end, there was something called the Great Repeller and all sorts of lines of force. And at the other end, on the left-hand side, there was something called the Great Attractor. Now, on a scale, they showed the Laniakea cluster as a small part of it, which originally had been thought to be the biggest thing in the universe. And our galaxy, which contains millions of stars and is huge compared to us, is merely a pinpoint on that diagram. So the diagram now has become immense, and it's all connected electrically. And this is mind-blowing. And these are young people who are coming up with these theories and this information and presenting it at the conference. So when you say a tipping point, yes, you know, Wall has a bunch of scientists working with him, and then he has people like Dave Talbot and so on who are popularizers, and then he has funders, I mean people who are supplying large sums of money to keep this thing going. And I think they're all to be congratulated, because I think it's a heroic endeavor. They're trying to overturn what we used to believe about the physical universe and present a different picture of the reality of the physical universe. And I agree with all that.
It's going to fundamentally change so many things.
But absolutely.
Velikovsky was the first one to coin the term cultural amnesia, wasn't he?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. That's where he caught me. That's where I become attracted, because when I had been thinking about why Shakespeare, why has he survived and looks like he might continue to survive, and what is the attraction there? Cultural amnesia is the theory that we have built within us collective memories, but they're unconscious of these great catastrophes. And therefore, we have to do something about it, because otherwise we'll go nuts. So one of the things we do is a person like Shakespeare, who writes plays whereby we can revisit the catastrophes in disguise. But let me give you something else. Are you familiar with stock car racing?
Well, I know what it is, but I'm not that familiar. Yeah.
All right. These are great big cars. They're not small little Formula One racing cars. They're great big huge cars, and they bang into each other and so on. But in a stock car race, let's say we remember, you see, it's all to do with orbits. When everything in the sky was orbiting properly, there was universal peace, no catastrophes. But the minute something went out of orbit, or the minute something barged into the orbiting setup, then all hell broke loose. So if you have stock car racing, they go round and round and round. And every once in a while, one of them bangs into another and they burst into flames and the whole thing has to stop and then they start again. And it goes on and there are catastrophes and things happening. But at the very end, what does the winner do? He goes and takes a victory lap. And the victory lap says the safe orbit has been reconstituted. And every time we have a stock car race, we are reenacting Velikovsky. And then we're telling ourselves everything is okay now because the winner has reestablished the orbit again. So it's all a question of orbits. Let me put it a different way.
Well, didn't Wallace was explaining it to me that Saturn with Mars and Earth came in and it merged with the solar system that we have, you know, that we became part of, and that
the solar system is not what it used to be. Saturn had a different place, and now Saturn has become a satellite of the Sun. We were once, apparently according to Wall, associated with Saturn. We were a satellite of Saturn, but now Saturn has carried us into the solar system, and so you have, look, the moon circles around us. The moon rides on us, but the moon and Earth together rides around the sun, and the sun rides around the center of the galaxy, and our galaxy rides around the center of supergalaxies. So it's all connected. But let me give you these words: uniformitarianism. This was the scientific belief up until Velikovsky, and it said, in effect, nothing ever happened in the past different in volume or magnitude or force or destructiveness, different from what we see today. So it meant that everything in the universe has always proceeded slowly and carefully. Now, the opposite, this is Newton. Now, the opposite of uniformitarianism is Velikovsky catastrophism. Now, there is a middle course. There are certain biologists, like Stephen Jay Gould, who just passed away, who said that his theory was called punctuated equilibrium. It's a very cute word. It means most of the time the world is equilibrial, but occasionally there are violent punctuations. So you have a choice of three. If you take Newton, the world is always placid. If you take Stephen Jay Gould, the world is occasionally catastrophic. If you take Velikovsky, the world has been continuously catastrophic. So one of the products of Velikovsky's thinking was that he attacked Darwin. And this is what I believe completely. If you check and read up on Darwin, as I have done, you'll get a list of about 70 at least, biologists who all completely or partly deny Darwin. Now, my theory as a psychologist, because I'm looking at this, is quite simple. Newton and Darwin were both British. So these major theories upon which all of Western science is founded, Newton and Darwin, the bedrock of science, are both British gentlemen. I emphasize the word gentlemen. So Newton wanted to propose a theory of the universe where the universe behaves like a British gentleman. Mm-hmm. And Darwin proposed that new speciation takes 2 million years to happen because species change like a British gentleman, you see. Now, Velikovsky said, hey, when bombs dropped on the houses in London and they created craters, new flowers were found in those craters which had never existed before. Now, what that means is the pressure and the heat of the bomb created a new species instantly. So it didn't take 2 million years for these new flowers to come about. It took a tenth of a second, and there was new species.
Oh,
you
wow.
See? So Velikovsky throws, I mean, I've written something where I have part of a chapter 30 or 40 pages, and I think Darwin is completely nonsense. The whole point is that, let's put it this way, you have to take it from whom it comes. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm. Now, why don't you explain that, though, for the listeners?
Well, okay. Newton and Darwin proposed that the universe is uniformitarian, meaning nothing ever happened in the past different from what we see now, and therefore everything has been placid, uneventful, and moving slowly, changing very slowly, and the same thing happens in the cosmos, and the same thing happens in the emergence of new species. Now, catastrophism is precisely the opposite. I would say many books on science refer to uniformitarianism as gradualism. The basic belief, which is almost a religious belief, is that everything is gradual. And Velikovsky says, no, occasionally things are very sudden and they happen very fast. And it's not gradual. I've been looking for an antonym for gradualism. Suddenism is the best I can come up with. I don't like it, but it'll do. The opposite of gradualism is suddenism. And we have to understand that in our universe, things can change suddenly, catastrophically, on a global scale, because he deduced, and this is what was the thing that drove astronomers crazy, that the only way that all of these things could have happened that the ancient religions were talking about is if something very big came close to the Earth. It wasn't what we call terrestrial. It wasn't worldwide earthquakes. It wasn't worldwide storms. It was something that was extraterrestrial, meaning something came from outside. And this something happened to be very huge and interacted with the Earth, and therefore all of these things happened that the religions are picturing. And even Carl Sagan, Velikovsky's major antagonist in the 70s, said, if something very big came close to the Earth, then Velikovsky's right. All of these things would have happened. The only thing is that the solar system has been stable. You have to understand Harlow Shapley, who the astronomer at Harvard, said that the solar system has been stable for the past 3 billion years, and it's going to be stable for the next 3 billion. What is the underlying message? The underlying message is don't worry. In other words, big science is really telling us don't worry. And Velikovsky is telling us, worry. So, if you believe that the solar system has not changed for 3 billion years and won't change for the next 3 billion, which is what Shapley wrote in a letter, then Velikovsky must be wrong. But if Velikovsky says that the recent means the last 4 or 5,000 years, recent history of the solar system is one of huge catastrophes, global in extent, caused by bodies coming close to the Earth, then the history of the solar system is catastrophic. And that's the big contention between them. That's what Velikovsky is offering, and that's what Wall Thornhill is after.
Well, and let me ask you, now, is this something that he thinks is a pattern that happens on a regular basis every 5,000 years or something? Or is it that we suddenly had a change 5,000 years ago, and it could have been a million years before that we had another change?
Good question. There's no, as far as I know, there's no inbuilt regularity to the catastrophes. What happened was that the solar system, going back before 5,000 years, was set up in a different way, and it began to decay. It began to create internal problems. It began to have perturbations. And once the perturbations occurred involving Saturn and the myth of the flood, which Velikovsky says was an earlier catastrophe, and water coming from Saturn, then the solar system has rearranged itself. Now, right now, it's fairly stable. So you cannot say that in 5,000 years it's going to go haywire again. That's a good question you put. I don't know that Velikovsky ever proposed a regularity to the catastrophes, but he is certainly saying that if you look at the world's religions and if you look at the geological history of continents, for instance, he found that on the edges of the North American continent there are islands, and these islands consist of millions of pieces of crushed trees and bones of animals. And he said the only way that could have happened is if there had been a tidal wave that swept across the top of North America and broke everything in its way and killed everything in its way, and then it was all dumped offshore in the Arctic Ocean where these islands exist. Now, the point is that people have analyzed the content of these islands, and they contain bones of all kinds of animals, some of which are extinct. So it means, and there are also artifacts in there created by human beings. That means human beings created these shaped stones at the same time that the mastodon and so on, which don't exist now, were all there. And all of this was crushed together and squashed into islands offshore. Now, the only thing that can do this has to be of a massive size, and it has to be catastrophic.
But he found that there's numerous catastrophic situations that happened.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He wrote about the most recent ones in his books that he published. He had a plan to publish other books about earlier catastrophes. But because he was attacked and because he had to, in the 1950s, he was all alone. He was just a little man all alone. When all these people began to come on board, by the 70s, it was the 25th anniversary of Worlds in Collision, I went down to Princeton to give a talk at a conference there. Big science had to really get against him because they said, we've been trying to get rid of this guy for 25 years and he's still hanging around. But what he's talking about is a rearrangement of the solar system, and now it appears to be stable. How long it will continue to be stable, we don't know. Look, one of the ways they jumped on Velikovsky in the 50s is he said that a number of the miracles in the Bible have normal scientific explanations the moment you accept catastrophes. So somebody said to him, all right, big shot, what about Joshua holding his hands up in the air and the sun standing still? How can the sun stand still? Well, we know that the sun does not stand still. We know that we revolve around the sun, and we also revolve on our terrestrial axis, and that gives us the day and night. So if you can retard or slow up the revolution of the Earth, it would look like the sun was not moving. See, every time we see sunrise and sunset, the sun is not rising, the sun is not setting, we are simply revolving on our earthly axis, and it looks like it. So all you have to do is slow up the revolution of the Earth, and it would look like the sun is slowing down, and you would have the miracle of Joshua. So he explained everything in terms of normal science, as long as you accept that these catastrophes occurred. And this drove people crazy because the scientists in the 1950s did not want to be associated with religion or religious fanatics, and Velikovsky was putting it all together. His picture of religion, his picture of science, his picture of ancient history, his picture of psychology, it was all together, and it all came from one explanation.
Well, and I always thought, and this is what he's doing, is that if religion is true, there would be a scientific explanation for it. We just don't understand it.
Of course, of course. Now, he wrote an explanation of the 10 plagues of Egypt when the Israelites left. And you could read that. It's the historical books are called Ages in Chaos. There's two or three volumes, and you can read one of them. And what he discovered is that there's a ancient, ancient Egyptian papyrus, which is supposed to be 700 years after the Exodus, but it gives the same picture. Everything that is in the 10 plagues is listed in this papyrus. Mm. And if you simply move the two of them together and put them in the same period, then they all line up, and there's a perfectly logical explanation for the 10 plagues of Egypt, and the rivers turning to blood, and frogs falling from the sky, and the period of darkness, and everything else. It all has a perfectly plausible scientific explanation, as long as, sorry, I've got a tickle. As long as you admit or allow Velikovsky's earlier theory that giant catastrophes were happening.
Well, you talked about the flood was water from Saturn.
Yeah, that's a different one entirely. He says that when Saturn and the Earth separated, when the order of the solar system was rearranged, seem to have a tickle, then a lot of water would have been sent off from Saturn in every direction, and the Earth received a lot of it, and that was the flood. And he says that Saturn and the flood is an earlier catastrophe.
So, and that would have
Venus.
And that would have flooded to the point where almost all the land was underwater.
Yeah. But, I mean, religions make it into a big story. You know, it went on for 40 days, mm-hmm. and finally they sent out a bird, and the bird could not see any land, and then finally the bird did see some land. These are different ways in which the religions clothe the stories for their believers.
Sure. And they saw, he saw it everywhere, right? I mean, these patterns were in these religions
everywhere.
From
everywhere you look,
every
there's
culture.
The myth of the flood. Everywhere you look, there's a myth of the sun standing still. If you look at Worlds in Collision, it's a book of comparative religion where he goes around the world and finds the same stories everywhere. So he says either everybody made up the same stories, pure coincidence, or they had a common basis. And his theory is they all were experienced and then recorded in childish fairy tale mythological terms by different religions.
You know what's
but
interesting?
He finds them all over the world.
What's interesting is there's nothing wrong with that kind of conclusion. That makes sense. There's
of course
a
it
lot
does.
Of logic to that. And to just of completely course. Write it off would be that's more ludicrous to completely
yeah,
write
yeah.
off.
See, I like to think of a man coming down from Mars. And I meet him, and he says, okay, show me what you believe in. Show me your religions. And I show him a number of religions, and he looks at me and says, you know, Irving, they seem to tell the same story. You see, and I say, you know, they're right. They may tell the same story, and they may have a common cause, you see. But this man from Mars, who is not arriving with prejudices, has his mind open to seeing the similarities, which is what Velikovsky did.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean that all of his conclusions are right. It just means, hey, let's look at this differently so we can figure it out.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, so what ideas did he propose have now been proven to be true? Because there's a lot of things that he said that we're starting to really see was true. And even regular science is saying, yeah, that was right.
Yeah. There's a couple of articles about this that were published in the 1960s. They put together a lot of predictions of his that all turned out to be right. And science said, well, these were all lucky guesses. They don't really count. And he said things like, Jupiter will be seen to give off radio noises. Everybody said it's impossible. Well, he was right. everybody said that the planet Venus was supposed to be like a sister planet of the Earth, and the temperature on Venus would be within 100 degrees of earthly temperature, you see. Velikovsky said, not at all. It's going to be much, much hotter. And they came back and they said the temperature of Venus, to our surprise, is about 600 degrees. And Velikovsky said it'll be hotter than that. And it turned out to be 900 degrees. And these are all logical offshoots of his theory. There are many of them. There are dozens of them. And they should all be checked out, because he was not a fool. He was a brilliant man. I think that this is one of the major intellectual efforts of the 20th century, one of the major scientific efforts of the 20th century, and I think he should be recognized as one of the great men of the 20th century.
He should be like a Newton or an Einstein. I mean, he's
absolutely,
or Galileo, or somebody who's just at that level.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And same with Wallace Thornhill, you think?
Well, Wall, you know, if Wall keeps going, he's going to get himself a Nobel. You understand, the Nobel Prize is given each year, let's say, in astronomy or physics, not for coming up with the complete final answer to something, but with moving the research ahead, a big step forward. And if Wall is right about this, this is going to be a very big step forward. But the point is that big science hates Velikovsky. They still hate him 75 years later. And they would rather commit collective suicide. They would rather cut their throats than admit that Velikovsky was right. Now, if they give an award to Wall, they're going to have to say, because Wall is a continuation of Velikovsky, they're going to have to admit that Velikovsky was right, and they would rather die. You see? So what do you do with that sort of situation?
But he's doing some interesting things that are proving out the theories, right? I mean,
A
lot of things are happening in the labs that are proving it out, but he's doing something credible now that's going even farther to prove it out, so that without a shadow of doubt, this is a real deal. Well, they've already done a lot of that, but can you explain a little bit what they're doing? I know it's a little bit premature.
Oh, okay. Well, the project is called the SAFIRE Project, S-A-F-I-R-E, and what they've done is they haven't got the money to send spaceships up and send them close to the sun and test all sorts. They've cost billions of dollars. So they've set up in a lab a miniature solar system, and they fire things and send pulses and so on in a miniature form. But if they can prove that they're right in the miniature, then you can just extrapolate that to the solar system and say they're right. So if they actually prove that electromagnetism plays a major role in all astronomical bodies' movements, this will be an enormous revolution in the way we look at what is physical reality.
By more and more, you know, getting to that tipping point where enough people really identify with this, how do you think it's going to change physics and medicine and all these major disciplines? Yeah, how do
everything
you think? Give us, paint a little bit of a picture for people so they can see, you know, what does that mean?
If you're talking about the physical universe, or let's say physics, which is supposed to be giving us a picture of physical reality, physics can only talk about what it can observe. It cannot observe things beyond the limits of observation. Now, there obviously is something out there. There cannot be nothing beyond the limits of observation. It's just that we can't see that far. So when physics talks about the universe, what they're really saying is the universe that we can see. That's all.
Sure.
And not only that, but they can't see everything within the universe. So physics will have to change, because the moment you allow electromagnetism or electricity to be a major force, then the movements of the planets, everything else will change. We will reinterpret it in a different way.
It'll allow us to understand how we can really move within the universe, and we can, I mean, because right now we're limited by our understanding, not being like, we're using a framework that's not quite accurate. So changing the framework to something that is will completely open our ability up to,
to
be able to travel the stars for real, because now we have a framework that works.
It'll be a totally different way of seeing physical reality. And therefore, if he's right about ancient chronology, we will change all that as well, because the picture of how different countries have evolved in different cultures, Egyptian culture, Greek culture, all of that will have to be revised in terms of what Velikovsky is talking about. And our own psychology, which to me is the most fascinating, what makes us behave the way we do on a large scale? In other words, excuse the language, why are we fucking up life on Earth so badly? If you look at the news, all you hear about is murders and killings.
Yeah, why are we so out of
whack? By the thousands.
Yeah.
Why can't we live on Earth happily? You see, there we have problems, we have hang-ups. But if you learn to discover the hang-ups, then you can help the patient to change. Velikovsky was trained by Freud. He's a psychoanalyst. And he said that the most difficult thing when dealing with a patient is not to discover what his problem is, but how to tell him about it and get him to accept it. That is the most difficult for any psychoanalytic procedure. Well, Velikovsky was trying to do this with his books. And of course, he didn't follow his own advice, because he just barged in and told the world, look, this is your problem. And the world said, to hell with you, you see. So he didn't behave like a good psychologist, as he was trained to do, because his book simply laid out the problem and most people couldn't accept it. And they went ballistic and they tried to destroy him.
Well, and that's a common theme in human history. But one thing Wallace was saying, and I find this absolutely fascinating, and I want to dig into this more, but by understanding how our bodies work, we can understand how to tune ourselves better with the universe. And a lot of the out of tuning, or a lot of the chaos, could be just we're out of tune. We just are just whacked out.
Yeah,
he didn't use the word whacked out.
No, but that's fine. We are electrical machines. You know that people try to deny it, but on the days of the full moon, things go haywire. The police know this. There's many more motorcycle accidents, there's violence, there's murder, because the full moon is sending down pulses upon us, and we are receiving this, and some of us behave in a very erratic way. So you take this and you expand it. We are electrical machines. If there was some way, you know, you can take a car and you bring it into a dealer and he plugs it in, and they test this and test that, and they tell you just what's going wrong. If we could have some machine like that, where they hook up a whole lot of things to us, and they get an electrical reading of us, they would say right away, we know what's wrong here, 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 and they would take care of it, because we are electromagnetic machines.
You know,
our bodies are.
The Eastern religion, or the Eastern medicines, tapped into a lot of that, right?
Yeah.
And they just didn't know exactly. They had a different, you know, the chi, the energy. They didn't they didn't put it in this science. It seems that this is making an answer to them. We ignored it completely. We thought Eastern medicine was a joke, and we just were in a Western medicine. And that's starting to move into our consciousness, that Eastern medicine, there was something there. But by doing this, now we're taking a whole leap forward. It brings value back to Eastern medicine in a major way. And it brings a holistic picture to the story. And it could really help with bringing peace and just a stability and a calmness to a lot of lives.
That's what we hope. I mean, people ask me, what do I care what happened 4,000 years ago if this planet bumped into that one or something? What difference does it make? Well, first of all, it tells me who we are as human beings on Earth. And secondly, we all hope to be able to get beyond this maniacal urge we have to kill and destroy ourselves, because the 20th century did not have a single year, I think, where there was no war. And this is supposed to be the pinnacle of human society, where there would be no war. Well, we had war every year. We had war every month. So the Eastern religions see it, but in their way. If you approach it through Velikovsky, you get the idea that you can give it a pragmatic, scientific foundation for what's going on.
You bring the Western idea of science to the Eastern idea of energy and calmness and, you know, balance, and it brings it all together. Because Eastern and Western medicine and Eastern and Western philosophies really need to come together, but our framework needs to work so that it just
the
makes
framework
sense.
Framework is important, because Eastern medicine tries to cure on a global scale. Western medicine tries to cure specifically. If you've got something wrong, they give you a chemical. Somebody else has something wrong with him differently, they give him a different chemical. But have you ever heard of Hans Selye, S-E-L-Y-E?
No, I have not.
Okay. He taught at my university, and he was a psychologist, and he was trained in Vienna. So the story he tells, I've heard him tell this story, is that when he was a young doctor, he went around with the other medical trainees, and they would go into a ward, and they would look at one person who had A, B, and C wrong with him, and they would diagnose it as X. Another person had X, Y, and Z, and they would diagnose it differently, because the symptoms were all different. And Selye said to us, the one thing they missed was that all these people were sick. There was a commonality to it. So he came up with the idea of stress, which sounds simple to us, but it was revolutionary then. And of course, it's been accepted, and he is the man who's associated with stress. But what he says is that when you have stress, one person has a pain in his ear, and the other has a pain in his thumb, and the other has a pain in his toe, but these are all surface manifestations of something common underneath, which is not even physical. It's mental, and it's called stress. So when we in the West learn to get beyond what we call analysis, analysis in the Greek sense means you take things and you break them up into little pieces, and you look at the pieces and you try and determine what you know about each little piece. In the East, they try and put it all together. Now, some of the physicists that I admire, one of them is called David Bohm, B-O-H-M. He just died a couple of years ago. But he was dealing with all the problems of physics and how you couldn't resolve quantum mechanics with relativity and so on. And he said there is an underlying layer. Now, he gave it different names. One of the names is called hidden variables. But what Bohm was asking for is go deeper and find the common basis for all the different surface phenomena. And that's where Western science must head. It's got to go there.
Exactly.
But they're not trained to do that, you see. They're trained to look at specifics and never mix different specifics. And Velikovsky said, no, you got to go deeper and deeper and deeper until you find the common ground for all of it, for our science, for our history, for the wars we make, for the works of art we turn out, for the music, for the sports, for everything. It all comes from a common cause. And that's really Velikovsky's major contribution. Well, and that's why I think he's very important.
Well, didn't Einstein and him became friends?
Yeah.
And Einstein, from what I understand, I read some stuff on him, that he actually wanted to fund research to prove out some of his theories, but he never got to it because he died before he had
He died. He died young. And his secretary at the time, who was called Helen Dukas, D-U-K-A-S, of course, she's the one who lived with Einstein every day, and she was trying to protect his reputation. And therefore, she tried to downplay Velikovsky's association with Einstein, because she didn't want Einstein to be associated with that crank. You understand? Everybody called Velikovsky a crank. But Velikovsky wrote a book. It hasn't been published. I think it's called Till the Day Breaks. I've seen a text of it, where it goes through his whole correspondence with Einstein, which goes back over 50 or 60 years, and it gives quite a different picture. You know, Velikovsky tried to found a Hebrew university in Jerusalem in the 1920s, and Einstein was to be the head of the science section of the Hebrew university and contributed some articles, so they knew each other since the 20s. And then when Einstein came to America escaping Hitler, he was taken up by Princeton University and lived off campus. And when Velikovsky retired at a certain point, he moved to Princeton, and they were neighbors, and they used to talk. And they come from the same background, and they speak the same language, and so on. And so this is very important, and people have downplayed it because Einstein has such a huge reputation, and Velikovsky is known as a crank, so they don't want to see the two together. But they should.
Well, now, do you think he was known as a crank because their egos were bruised, they were challenged?
Oh, yes.
And they... It wasn't as much of, because looking at it and saying all, you'd think they'd have to be intellectually curious a little bit, saying all these myths are having the same stories. I mean, how can they just write that off? Was it they were protecting their fields and their careers and reputations versus not believing it themselves?
They were protecting their turf, but also they had been trained to look at physical reality in a certain way. And Velikovsky's way of looking at it was what we would call more holistic.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it encompasses various things that are all brought in together to form a global explanation. And they couldn't take that because this was a challenge to every major university scientific department. They were all being told, you'll excuse me, you're full of shit. You understand?
Well, and so now, when do you think, I mean, I know there's, what have you seen? Have you seen some universities taking on some of this stuff?
Or,
yes. See, I think I have too. You know, I'm seeing that. When do you think the tipping point will happen?
That's a very good question.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at the idea of a tipping point, 10 seconds before it happens, you're going to think, well, it's going to take a long time. And all of a sudden, it tips and everything changes. Now, is it going to take some new discovery brought back by one of the space probes that really says, hey, you know, Velikovsky is right? If you look at, you know, there's a video put out of the 2017 conference. You can get it if you like. You have to pay for it, but it's not expensive. And it shows all the different speakers. And they're coming from different points. I look upon it as spokes in a bicycle wheel. The spokes start off in different areas, but they all head towards the hub, and the hub is the central idea. So these speakers were spokes in different directions, but they were all trying to make the same point about electricity in the universe. And if, when, I don't know how, it's going to happen, then everything will tip suddenly. It'll be like us pouring water out of a jug. It'll all go. And one of our guys, Lynn Rose, who died a couple of years ago, said pessimistically, big science will continue to deny Velikovsky and make fun of him, but they will absorb some of his ideas and then say that they knew about it all along. They will not give him any credit.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of that going on right now. I think a lot of scientists are using this whole electric universe theory behind the scenes and not publicly saying it.
Yes, yes, and you know, on the one hand, they're attacking him. There's a journal called the C Skeptical Inquirer. It's edited by a man called Michael Shermer, who is a sort of scientist, and he came to visit the Electrical Universe group about 4 years ago, and then he wrote a report, which is, I think, disgusting, short, a put-down, not respectful at all, but they're trying to attack Velikovsky while they're looking to see if there's any nuggets in there that they can use to advance their own careers.
Sure, yeah.
But if something spectacular happens, everybody's going to say, look, this is all connected to Velikovsky and Wall Thornhill and people like that, and their theory is an inclusive global theory. And people are going to say, well, if they're right about this, then they're right about the whole picture. And therefore, our whole picture of who we are and what we're doing on Earth and what has happened in the Earth and what all of this means and what does society mean and what does culture mean, all of that will change. All of it.
Well, what do you think, or what did Velikovsky say about the pyramids that we're finding everywhere, all over the planet?
Yeah. Well, to him, one of the main purposes of the pyramid is it's the most stable structure you can imagine. You see, if you have a structure with four corners, it can tip. But if you have a pyramid with three corners, there's no way you can tip it. It's the most solid structure in the world. And you can imagine when they put these things up, just think of it. We like to think that we are so advanced in mathematics, but they could build these things with passageways inside that would allow the sun to come through so they could see what they're doing in painting and then closing it up. And how do you design a pyramid with tens of thousands of huge stone blocks in such a way that you leave internal passages? It's almost mind-boggling how you would design it. And yet they did it 4,000 years ago.
Well, but they also, they're finding that these things are older in a lot of, you know, like the Egyptian basin. Yeah, but they're finding these things all over the place. And the amazing thing is, you know, like the obelisks are so huge.
Yes.
You know, that's not something.
And they move things that size.
Exactly.
Look at the Sphinx. A number of our people have written articles about the Sphinx. And the Sphinx shows signs of water erosion.
Exactly.
Now, the area where the Sphinx is found on the edge of the Sahara Desert is supposed to have been dry for the last 20,000 years, but it hasn't, because when the Sphinx was built, there was water, there was flooding, and so on. So something must have happened to change the Sahara overnight from a land full of rivers, as they've discovered ancient riverbeds and everything in the Sahara, change it overnight into one of the driest places on Earth. And how do you do that unless you have some enormous force tipping the Earth over to make it happen? So people will discover all these things, because most of the pictures we've been given about the history of cultures and the history of nations and the history of different armies and battles, Velikovsky says, was wrong. For example, if you know anything about the Greek ages, they talk about the Bronze Age. Mm-hmm. Most of lasted from about minus 3,500 to about minus 800, something like that. And they divided very neatly into early bronze, middle bronze, and late bronze. We always like to have three, you know, the Goldilocks and the Three Bears, there's three. And the witch gives you three wishes, and we always have three in our mythology. Well, they have found subdivisions of early, middle, and late bronze, and sometimes subdivisions. So if you read a scholarly article about EB2A, that's early bronze 2A, we keep subdividing it, but we cling to the number 3, and we take 1, 2, and 3, and we divide them up and subdivide them up, and it's all nonsense. the number three is imposed by us. If you look at it, there were actually 19 periods in the Bronze Age, but we like to think of it as three. And the point is, they assess these things by a change in the pottery. So when pottery is thrown out, they find refuse dumps, and they can see that there's been a change in the pottery. But if you were alive 4,000 years ago, what would they do? You had an iPhone, and you would get a message on your iPhone, tomorrow morning at noon, early bronze 2A will change to early bronze 1B, and you are to take all your dishes and throw them in the garbage so that the archaeologist can come along 4,000 years later and say, aha, there was a change. This is all nonsense. It's absolute, complete nonsense. And yet, this is what students are taught in the universities about early, middle, and late bronze. We simply like the number three. We have the Neolithic, the Stone Age. We have the early Paleo-Neolithic. We have the middle Mesoneolithic. And we have the late, Paleolithic, Mesolithic, and Neolithic. We like to have neat divisions of three. Everything goes in one, two, and three. This has got nothing to do with the evidence. It's only got to do with us. So all of that will change. And what will happen is we'll see ourselves and we'll see the whole world differently.
Well, how do you think he'll end up being remembered? Ultimately,
I think eventually justice has to triumph. I mean, you know, there's a statement that somebody said that ideas in science don't change. It's the proponents who die off. And when they are dead, the younger people come along and are more willing to accept new ideas. That's how... Excuse me, this idiot coughed. That's how ideas change in science. Now, I think that you cannot keep Velikovsky suppressed forever. If we look at his history, it's only 75 years, which is a very short time in terms of thousands of years that we're talking about. But I think there's a crescendo of support for him and for the work that Wall Thornhill is doing and other people. And for proponents, polemicists like myself, who are interested in the history and philosophy of physics and science and can see the larger picture, I think that eventually people will accept what he tried to do and see it as a huge change on a global scale of many, many, many disciplines together, having a common basis. That's the way I see it.
Yeah, I think that it would just be a renaissance of new ideas. It would be incredible.
Well, absolutely.
Do you mind to stick around? I have patrons who support my program and answer another question for them after the show is done.
Want me to stay on the line?
Yeah, will you stay on the line and ask another question for my patrons as we close out here?
Sure.
But let's ask one more question before we leave. Are you going to be speaking at any more conferences or anything with people?
I'm going to be speaking at the next Electric Universe Conference.
And that's going to be 2018 in August?
2018, and I think it's going to be held, I'm not sure, but I think it's Denver in 2018.
And it's always in August, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, great. People should look for you because this is just an amazing. I just thank you so much for speaking with us today. And please hold on. But thank you so much.
Sure. My pleasure. You know, we professors are paid to talk. So you just turn us on and we talk.
Well, I like that. Okay. Hold on.
Sure.